Howdy, howdy, how we doing, beautiful people? Now today's guest is an absolute wonder. He has the surname the same as the capital city of Germany. He is a man who's been in Coronation Street. He's a man that drops many wisdoms about the company scene. He's a man that switched more into the acting side of things. And he started comedy in 2005. Been doing comedy for, well, he's involved in comedy for over 15 years. There's many gems to share, there's many fascinating tales to say. You guys are gonna love him like a good fish and chips of tartar sauce. Please welcome the amazing, the adventurous, the joyous Gareth Berliner.
Boom, boom, boom. Hello.
Hello, mate.
How are we doing, Gareth? You all good? All
right. Yeah, how are you?
Not too bad. I'm enjoying the lovely weather back in London. My foot's got better. I couldn't walk for a couple of weeks, but now I can walk again. So everything's all good.
Good. Congratulations. Why couldn't you walk?
Oh, I did a backflip whilst I was in Italy doing the course. And
doing what course when you're in Italy? What course?
I was doing a physical theatre course with the mask. Mask theatre course.
Okay. Interesting. Interesting.
And doing the movement class. We do all these little exercises like the judo front roll and other things to try and, I still couldn't get right, but different things to try and be more flexible. And effectively I did the backflip, and someone who was supposed to catch me from behind, they did catch me, but I fell on my right ankle and it twisted a bit like this, like I was doing a upward kung fu move like this.
Yeah, nasty.
And then doing this.
Yeah, nasty.
But for 2 weeks I wasn't able to walk. I can walk now, but it's a bit of a weird thing. Sometimes there's a lot of pain when walking, but sometimes it's perfect. So I don't know what it is at the moment. It's a bit like a moody teenager, my ankle.
Sure, sure. But surely, are you a changed man for the 2 weeks of not being able to walk? Do you appreciate the benefit of your legs now?
I fucking do, yes. I bloody do,
good.
Yes, definitely. I mean, definitely. 100%.
These things that keep you up, man.
What about you? How's Coronation Street? No, I shouldn't be asking you.
That's 2019 that ended. I've done a lot of stuff since then. But it was very interesting. It did create quite a bit of change at the time in my life. I didn't have an acting agent, so it got me an acting agent for a start. But it was a lot of noise in the background. We've got building work. My wife's just going to shut the door. It was a bit mad, man. I'd always wanted to act, but you can't just get an agent. I love doing stand-up, and I suppose I always wanted to get discovered one day, and it doesn't just happen like that. And then there was just an opportunity that came up for a part that they never created. It was like an open audition. I went for that. They never created it, so nothing happened. And then they just phoned me months later. And it started off as just, you know, a couple of eps and just went on to kept coming back. But it was great because it got me an agent.
Oh, well, it's a funny thing, you know. I heard from Dave Thompson that he said that when you're in this sort of business, that there's some doors that will never open, but being involved in it, you're going to get a door that will open that you never expected if you're in it long enough.
So I would say, A, you know, it was an amazing opportunity. I think I wouldn't have got... take what?
Your ring's off.
I'll take my ring. Okay, so good to have a director in the background, you know what I mean? I've got a... Thanks, babe. I got the best director. Take your rings off because they're banging. It was an amazing opportunity. I mean, it opened the doors into having an acting agent and starting an acting career. Also, in my stand-up world, opened some doors in terms of, I guess, you know, I was starting to get some headline spots, I had been getting headline spots, but it opened the doors to some paid work that I wouldn't have got if I didn't have a TV credit that someone could sell. Like, to you know, and that doesn't mean you'd have an audience of Coronation Street fans who it meant anything for, but it's someone off the telly. It's familiarity, even if they don't even watch the show.
Yeah.
Good for selling tickets. So you just get a few more opportunities.
And you get to, yeah, so it's like the Kate Copstick quote in a way, in that you can use it to sell.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And it's a selling game, and you realize when an opportunity like that happens, like when that happened for me, it started to mean that when I applied for a gig, you know, I was humble, so I couldn't go, hey, I've been on the Apollo and Mock the Week, you know, but I could go, oh, and also, you know, I'm doing this if, you know, if it helps for a poster, for advertising, for whatever. And sometimes that would lead to a booking that I might not have got.
Yeah. You have to play, you're saying that you have to play the game a little bit.
Absolutely. Well, I mean, it depends, you know, where your moral compass is at and how much you want to work. But I mean, I wanted to work, and it was a way. And also, you know, when you are a pro act, you know, initially you might start as an MC or an opener, and you hope to graduate to being like the paid headliner. So if you're given an opportunity, even if you lack experience, you know, I can think of an act, not naming anyone, where they had something happen in the world that gave them an amazing opportunity, but they only perhaps were like a 10-minute act at the time, but it stepped them up to 20-minute and headline sets, and they just had to raise their game. But they now exist, you know, and probably got there quicker than they would have.
Is that, yeah, that's a funny thing, isn't it? Stephen Grant said that with a 10-minute set, you can pad it with a good 5 if you're very lucky. But with a 20-minute set, is that possible? Or would you say no, because it's so much longer? If you have a good 10?
I can hear the 5 minute to a 10. And, you know, I think when you're starting out with your first 20, it's rare that someone that's got their first 20 waits till it's bulletproof as a 20 before they go out and do it at a gig. But what you've got to do on your way up to building your 20 is a shit sandwich. So whatever is your weaker material that you wish you'd left behind, or is not as strong as the new material you're writing, until you have that solid 20, you shit sandwich with the mediocre material in the middle, because you know you're going to close strong and you know you're going to open strong.
Yeah. Have you seen it catapult into complete disaster when someone's done that? I bet you have. Or you witnessed.
Yeah. But I mean, I think we all, like, you know, I'm sure it's happened to Stephen. It's like, everyone can die at any gig. It's possible. No matter how much you think a room is set up for you, or the perfect audience for you, or an audience that you're going to fail at and you'll be surprised because they love you, because you're everything they're not. So I always did my best to not judge the audience. But yeah, you can fall spectacularly halfway through. It's whether or not you can claw it back, you know, which is why you should always have your strongest material at the front and the end. So you know you're definitely going to go somewhere, you know, you can turn it around.
You have to keep fighting like Nadal.
Yeah. And I think it's magical when you're starting out as a comic. Obviously, at the beginning, you have more failures than success. I think as you go on, there's nothing like the first time you turn a room around, especially if you go on stage and start with a room that from the off doesn't like you or doesn't get you. And it's really interesting. I've made note, Australian audiences compared to like London. Okay. Cause I started gigging in London on the open mic scene there. I would say a London audience on the whole will give an act 3 minutes of grace. And if in those 3 minutes, they haven't really pulled it out the bag, they may struggle to ever turn that room around, because they're, you know, and the audience is just too judgmental in London. In Australia, they have a much more have a go attitude. So when I was gigging over there, I noted that like an open spot could go over there to a 10-minute open spot. They could be dying for 9 minutes. But if in the 10th minute they brought it back, the audience would be like, ah, fair play, mate. You gave it a go. Good on you. No, they like to see, you know, Australians have a little bit more of an attitude of give it a go and giving someone a go. Whereas London, you know what the London scene is like for open mic nights. It's very harsh.
Oh, brutal. I witnessed it bloody last week. I got back into my first gig MC. I was completely unprepared. It was, no, I did a lot of reviews. I chatted to the audience afterwards. I gave a phone call and I chatted to the owner. I chatted to the comedians afterwards. So I'm more prepared next time to make sure it doesn't happen. Yeah. But I was completely taken off guard, not gigged for quite a few months. And yeah, it is what it is. I think the thing that I find funny about comedy, because I had a Swedish comic come on here and he's... Yeah. He went to Austin and he was disappointed. He said they're poor, even though it's the big comedy hub. And he said,
What do you mean he said they were poor?
He said they were dreadful, most of them.
Oh, the acts.
Yeah, the comedians, even though Austin's supposed to be the next big comedy hub, like the Northwest is supposed to be at the moment in the UK.
Sure, sure.
He said that they were dreadful and that the comedians in Sweden were way better. I mean, the thing about that is, just because someone's had one bad gig when you've seen them, it is hard not to judge them as bad. But when you see them, one person do a bad gig once, you're going to have that judgment of being terrible. But I think, as you said, anyone can have a bad gig.
Yeah, I think, like, if I were to offer to advice to any act, my one important thing is, if you've been booked for a gig, and if it's been a paid gig, and you've dropped the ball maybe during your set, but you've had a good set, the audience were entertained, they loved you at the end, they loved you at the beginning, you just dropped the ball a couple of times. Don't come off and make the first thing you say, if the promoter asks, how'd it go, if they weren't really paying attention, it was all right, but I dropped the ball. Like, just say you enjoyed yourself. It's like if an audience member comes up to you and says you were great and it was a night where you thought I was all right, but my best gags didn't get the normal laughs. Don't say to that audience member, I was all right, but if you saw me on another time, they thought you were the best they've ever seen you. And if you don't tell them different, next time they see you and you're on full form, they'll think you're amazing.
Ah, that's a good lie. You guys, you have to pay Gareth in Bitcoin. After the podcast, you have to send it over to his email address.
Be happy with that.
But so you've been doing comedy since 2005, right? How did you become a comedian? What happened? Did you see a woman at a bar that you're impressed by? There was a gig there. You're like, how do I impress this chick? I go up there, I make her laugh.
No, I love your romanticized version of what may have happened. Genuinely, mental health, I would say, led to it. I attempted to take my own life in the year 2000, which went on to be an Edinburgh show by 2005, the Comedy and Tragedies Plus Time. And I think the essence of my suicide story is that at the end of it, when I kind of saved my life and was fortunate in the situation I was in, there was a lot of laughter involved. I don't want to spoil it or tell the show story, but there was a lot of laughter involved. And I kind of came away from it working towards, obviously, get my mental health back, getting positive. I then ran into someone through a friend who was a comic. I told him my suicide story, which in itself is funny. Obviously tragic, but funny. And he started talking to me about doing gigs. I thought about it, and I normally, I have ADHD, so I could often get an idea and then spend, a couple of years romanticizing, talking about doing that thing, but maybe never doing it or starting it and not finishing it. And comedy was one of those things. And for a couple of months, I was saying, I'm thinking about giving stand-up a try. I'm thinking about giving stand-up a try because I'd found laughter so important to me. And then this guy just said to me, I've booked your first gig, you're on next week. If you die there, you'll never die worse. Because it was up the creek on the open mic night. And I couldn't get out of it. So I went and did the gig. It was the most amazing experience. I didn't die, but I didn't stall. Malcolm Hardy was the MC. And back in those days, it didn't matter how you did in those days. Malcolm would still say, well, that was shit when you got off. And I remember that the thing that tells me how powerful it was at the time that I always remember is I was sat at the bar after I'd done my first set. I bought myself a shot of whiskey, I think, a double shot or something. There was a beautiful woman that I remember, like, just catching out of my eye to the right, carried on watching, you know, the next act, but full of this adrenaline. I remember her turning to me and, like, she introduced herself. You were saying about the beautiful woman at the bar and impressing them. She introduced herself. She offered to buy me a drink because I'd just been on stage and, you know, got a few laughs. And I was so caught up in the adrenaline, the ego, the energy boost, the magic of having just done my first gig, that I was like, I'm all right, thanks. Because I was just in this bubble that couldn't be penetrated, and I wasn't thinking with my dick. I was just like, you know, it was amazing. I'll never forget that first gig. And once you start, if you want it to be a career, then it has to be addictive. And I think it becomes addictive. And your bad gigs are the gigs that you benefit from. You get nothing from a great gig. It's lovely to have them. And as you go on in your career, you have a lot more lovely gigs than bad ones. You die a hell of a lot less than you may have died at the beginning. But you learn everything in the difficult and shit gigs.
Yeah, that's true. Is there's even motivations. There's people that are even motivated by pleasure. I read this in a book somewhere. People are motivated by pleasure, or they're trying to avoid pain. I think for myself, I avoid trying to avoid pain. That motivates me more than anything else. What would you say you are?
I guess so. I mean, comedy fundamentally changed a lot of things in my life. I went through all of my 20s. You know, in the romanticized notion you talk about, the girl at the bar to impress, I went through all of my 20s and my teens being everybody's friend and friend zoned a lot, because I had a disability, I had a chronic health condition. And so people saw me as a lovely guy. I mean, women saw me, I'm a straight guy. So women saw me as a lovely, nice guy, funny, but not the guy you go out with because he's ill and he's got issues and he's vulnerable and blah, blah. I think with stand-up, because I got on stage, and particularly with regard to mental health and the physical health, talked about it in an Edinburgh show and then talked about it in my stand-up, I showed any women that might have been interested in me in the audience that I was single, that I was confident, that I was dealing with whatever my condition was. And it kind of meant that anyone that was interested in me, like sexually or whatever, knew everything. I just spat everything out on the stage. So there weren't many secrets. It wasn't like meeting me and I've got to hide that I've got a condition. It was already on stage. And so it fundamentally changed that, opened me up, gave me confidence, enabled me to have relationships I hadn't had through my 20s. I had one girlfriend at like when I was 24. And prior to that, maybe, you know, a couple of girls when I was like 15, 16, that was it. Missed all of it in my 20s. And then in my 30s, had all my relationships, lived with someone, you know, was with people for a year or so until I finally met my wife, which again, I would say came through comedy.
That's one thing I've been going to see with comedy. I think it's the thing that I like about us as comedians is that we because we're able to attack a lot of our vulnerabilities and make fun of the weaknesses, I think that makes us stronger and more interesting as people, because these are things that most of us hide. But as comedians, we let it all out in there. We take the piss out of it. And does that make us stronger in a way that we do that?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's about ownership, isn't it? I mean, it's your story to tell. And I know that I remember doing Edinburgh. I remember I tried my show, my first show, Gutless. I tried it 6 months ahead of Edinburgh. I deliberately went to Australia to the Melbourne Comedy Festival. You have to be invited to the Melbourne Comedy Festival, you know, to really sell tickets. You need to be kind of someone who's welcomed in those days. It's a bit different now. So I was able to get a spot and pay to join the fringe, but I got very little support as an international act because I had no agent, no backing. You know, it's just me. I tried out the Suicide show, which was called Gutless, for a month there. Gained a lot of experience, learned what worked, what didn't work, rewrote stuff. went back to Edinburgh, went to Edinburgh that year for my first year doing a solo show, which a lot of my peers who were at stages above me weren't doing. Now everyone will go and do their hour, you know, whatever stage you're at in comedy, people try it. But it was an amazing experience for me. I got a lot out of that show and again, opened up doors for myself. Hmm. Sorry, I went off on a tangent there, but that's neurodiversity.
And that's a lot of us as comedians. We always do that, isn't it? One thing I've found with a lot of comedians, they always, some, I think, I honestly think if there's one condition I have, it's this condition. So many comedians I've met, they say they've got ADHD. And I honestly think that that's a condition I have. I don't, what is ADHD and what's the wrong definition of ADHD? What is ADHD?
I don't think there's a definitive descriptor for it. I think, you know, if you go with the idea that we're all on a spectrum to a degree, and some people are just on a very normal average spectrum, that's not knocking it, just means they function perfectly well, they can make appointments, they can remember things they have to do, they don't leave the house and have to think 20 times to go back to pick something up. They don't start on a project and not finish it. They just finish that project and stay focused on it. I can start on one thing at the beginning of the day and end up doing 20 different things and ignoring the main target. But they are also highly skilled at going in lots of directions, following multiple tangents. You know, I like to think what I've realized for me and how I define my ADHD is like there's a saying, Jack of all trades is a master of none, right? And I think when you're a comedian, if you have more than one string to your bow, be made to feel like, well, no, I can't focus 100% on comedy like everybody else. But the full saying is that Jack of all trades is a master of none, but oftentimes better than a master of one. And the fact that I can focus on lots of different things and get distracted, I have a lot of info up here. And for stand-up, being able to be in more than one world, I found for me particularly beneficial. And that was part of ADHD as well. It is part of ADHD as well. But I think, like, if you think you got it, man, go get a diagnosis. I mean, I know for me, all I can say is whatever people think about whether ADHD is a real thing or just we all have ADHD or whatever, you really don't. And B, finding out has massively enabled me and massively helped me understand failures I've had in the past, why some things haven't worked for me in comedy or didn't work for me necessarily, how my communication has been affected. And knowing I had ADHD, when I went and did a course at Lambda, I did a Shakespeare course for 8 weeks, I working not on my own, but within a group context, I became really aware of my issues with ADHD and learning lines and all of these different things. I think as solo performers, whilst there may be a lot of people in the comedy game with either ADHD or another neurodiversity, you are working for yourself. You're very rarely a team player. You're a team player on a bill, but ultimately you are just working with yourself. You're doing your own admin, you know, but I get overwhelmed by admin, and that's another ADHD trait.
One thing that happens with me is I'm very, I like to compartmentalize things. So if I'm doing admin shit and someone gives me a message or starts trying to talk to me on the phone, I'll be like, I'll hold this for a couple of hours. I'll finish the admin, then I'll get back to them. But trying to do two different things at once, that kills me, mate. I'm dreadful at that.
Well, I don't know. I don't know whether you have ADHD or you have, you're somewhere else on the spectrum or you're not on the spectrum at all. I think you should just look into it.
Oh, no, definitely. I mean, I get called, occasionally I get called autistic, but I had a test for it and it was, it wasn't quite.
How'd you do?
No, actually, I'm not having a test for it. What am I doing saying that? I get called it, but there's been no diagnosis or anything. So I think what I will do at some point, I'll try and get a test for ADHD and maybe a bit of autism, but I don't know. I think if there's one thing that I feel I have, I think it's ADHD more so than the autistic bit. I think I'm just a bit socially awkward and a bit of an oversharer.
Well, that's also every comedian.
That's true.
Many comedians, I should say, not every comedian. But aren't we just like that as people? We're relevant of comedians. Like I was like that as a kid before I ever became a comic. Like when I first got ill, I used to tell everybody because I remember that there was you know, like a problem shared is a problem halved. The more I talked about my condition, the better I used to feel. I didn't feel so isolated. I didn't feel so alone. And I think that's another one with comedians is feeling like often, you know, it's a stereotype, but I think there's a level on which comedians are oftentimes people who feel a little bit separate or a little bit of an outsider or a little bit different than everybody else. But I also think inherently there's a danger in committing fully to surrounding yourself solely and only with other comedians and only socializing with other comedians, because we're nothing without an audience, and an audience is made up of people who aren't comedians. And if you can't relate to people who aren't comedians, I don't know how well you can relate to an audience. You know what I mean?
Yeah. It's a good thing that I'm getting. A good thing that I work at other jobs.
Yeah,
I'd be the weirdo at the job.
But it is. It shapes you, and it enables. Like, it's no different. Every gig, you're meeting a different audience. Every gig, you're trying to entertain a different group of people with a different set of values or politics, according to where they are or a class that they're in. And so, the more of those people you meet out when you're not working and not gigging, and the more conversations you can have, the more rounded you can make your opinion and your appeal as a comic, because you can connect with everyone.
And the thing.
Mic drop.
Whoa! Yeah, that's really. No, I should put a, if I had a good, if I had a more sound equipment, I would have put a clapping sound or some cheering. Well,
I would have appreciated it, but I'll let it go.
Yeah, but you're also an actor as well. One thing, yeah, that's the thing that I like about comedians. We're willing to be more, you know, people talk about a great comedians like Richard Pryor and other things like that. But, you know, just a lot of stand-ups, we talk about our vulnerabilities and we're willing to be more honest about the ugly side of humanity. The thing that I've found with theatre people and actors, they have those sides in them, but they like to pretend that those sides don't exist, whilst comedians will be open and honest about these sort of things. But I found that's my personal experience, because I've been to Goliath, the clown school, I've been to this school in Italy, that for what I've found is they're not willing to, I feel from my personal experience, they're not willing to admit about the darker sides of humanity as comedians are.
I don't know. I would like to go back on something, if I may, in terms of starting out and going pro quickly. One thing I had back then, which I think still exists, is the opportunity to drive other comedians, because I had a car. So I worked a lot, and you'll hear of Murph Control and Jeff Whiting. I worked a lot for Murph Control at the beginning of my career, but it meant I got outside of London, because I think gigging solely in London as an open mic, it's a rude awakening the first time you do a gig away from home, because not everything you've got that you do in London is going to work in like Ilkley in Yorkshire. Do you know what I mean? And with Murph Control, by driving pro acts, I was watching a pro bill. I was the only, you know, unpaid act at the start. So I was watching a pro bill. I was learning from watching them. I was driving them to the gig and driving them home. And that meant sometimes those great conversations you have in cars with comedians, but the conversations you have with a bunch of open mics in a car are not comparable to the conversations you have with a bunch of pro comics in a car, because you learn a lot more from the conversations you're hearing from the pro comics, because they've got experience and they're talking about, they might be bitching about a promoter, they might be talking about someone who's booking, they might be talking about work they're planning to do. So, you know, I think one of the things we don't do enough sometimes as comics is listen. And I think trying to drive other comics around the country and volunteering, and also, sorry, it just came to mind, just because I just wanted to offer this advice to any comics, like volunteer to go on first, no matter how empty or quiet the night, because there's nothing like going on from cold. And if you go on from cold, if you're the first act up after the MC and you create laughter, you begin to get recognized as a good opening act for when someone books a pro bill. And if you fail when you're opening at the start of a night, well, you can tell yourself, well, it was cold and I was just starting and the evening was just beginning. And if you're the MC, that gets even easier, because you're going on cold, And if you do well, you're a great MC. You've got the night started. That's brilliant. You're the audience's mate. And if you don't get anything at the beginning and it's down to the opening act to kind of get something going, well, you did go on cold. And once they get some energy in the room, you'll get some energy in the room. But it is your goal as the MC to really get the night started. Sorry, I went off on one.
No, it's all good. It's all good. That's definitely true. And I'm going to steal that and hide it from everyone. No, I'm joking.
Now, honestly, opening, volunteering on open mic nights, you must have been at open mic nights where people are going like, can I go on in the middle? Can I go on seventh? Can I go on sixth? You must have seen that happen. And the true comic, the person that wants to test their mettle, the person that wants to get better, just goes, can I go on first? And actually, if you go on first and you're in central London, you know, I remember when I started, I thought it was a big deal if I managed to do two gigs in the same night. I remember Josh Howie, when I first met Josh, I was turning up at a gig that Josh was leaving to go to another gig. And that other gig he was going to was the third gig he'd done that night in central London as an up and coming open mic. You know, so when you're in London, the opportunities to gig more than once in the same night are multiple. So if you volunteer to open, you've got time to get from the gig in Covent Garden to the gig in Holborn.
Yeah.
Or wherever.
It's a bit like, isn't it a bit like what Louis C.K. did, where he deliberately used to put his, what did he used to do? He used to try and challenge himself, where he used to put the new joke at the end of his set or something like that to make himself better.
Yeah, but then the question is, if you do that, if you challenge yourself by putting a new joke at the end and hoping that that's going to get you a laugh and it doesn't, are you a strong enough comic to stick to your time and call a night to your opening 20? Or are you going to steal time from the MC and the next act and keep going and laughter your ego wants? Now, the true person should just be a professional and finish and say thanks very much. But it's interesting, you know?
But you said there's like the opposite of what a lot of us do. We run away from our problems rather than go and confront them. Well, do I get a mic drop there? Let's do that. No, I'm joking.
I mean, I think whenever you're having, you know, a good friend of mine, Mickey D, comic, when I was on my way up as an act, you know, be on the front foot when your audience is being odd. If you step back, if you genuinely physically, or even they can feel that you step back, you will lose them and you're telling them you fear them. If you have a hard time at a gig, step forward more. Like, I mean, physically, like if you're working your way to the back and you can feel it because you're struggling, step forward into them. Because people just register the confidence. And maybe challenge you less because maybe they don't want to mess with you now because you look confident. But when you look like a rabbit in the headlights when you're having a bad gig, you step back, you're telling them you are a rabbit in the headlights.
Stepping towards the fear rather than away from it.
Yeah.
All right. That just sounds like a fight when someone's trying to scare you and bully you.
Well, I don't know, maybe I don't think the audience... You know, I don't want to tar the audience with that brush. They just are what they are. It depends where you are and who you're gigging for. Because you can have audiences where it doesn't matter how good an act you are, they're just not going to have you. But I can think of, there's nothing more wonderful, I think, than a night where all the acts die and everyone thinks the audience is unplayable and the headliner comes on and rips the room apart. And that's when you really, really learn a hell of a lot from a night. When you think a night is unplayable and someone comes and still storms it, still wins it, still takes it. You got to learn.
I've had two tropes in this. There's a lot of comedians I come across that say no room is unplayable, but then there's others that say it is unplayable. I think I like your definition of it, others, because you're taking responsibility. Even if it's the case that the room's unplayable, it's better to have that mindset that you can some way try and win it.
Look, good acts take control of the room and don't let the room win. So, Martin Davis, who's in South Africa, he might be in South Africa now, might be back here. He did go off to South Africa for quite a few years. Martin Davis was one of the finest examples of comedians when I started out. He would walk into a room that was badly set up and reset the room up. He didn't say, "It's not my job." He set the room up to make the conditions better so that he would have a good night of comedy. So there's loads of stuff you can do to make an audience that you think is unplayable more playable, even to the point of getting, if you start a gig that you're running yourself and you have six rows of seat and everyone sat on the second row in and not the front row, you're capable of trying to encourage them to move forward and sit on the front rather than the dead zone of an empty front row. You know what I mean? There's loads of things you can do to make a night that seems unplayable playable. And if you're the MC, actually, one of my old tricks, and I probably got this from Martin, walk around the room, speaking to the people who are there, and asking them, "Oh, do me a favor, mate. It's going to make it better for the comics and you if you're at, if you're if the audience is right at the front. If you guys all hide at the back, it's going to be a shit night for everyone because it's harder for the comics to connect, and lying, no one's going to pick on you. Sit in the front, no one's going to pick on you."
That's true. That's true. That's a good lie. Now, what, so you've not gigged for a while. Are you going to get back into stand up? Oh, so
I think I will. At the moment, I don't feel the urgent, overwhelming need. At the moment, I'm working on writing and working on myself as an actor. So at the moment, I'm pushing into that and working on film scripts and scripts and trying to put together a production up here. So that's where my head's at the moment. But I would never rule out, gigging.
is there any, so I said some bits about being acting and come, I don't know that much about acting. I know a tiny bit from the people that I've come across. What are your experiences in actors and comedians as a whole, and how do they differ, and how does it all come together?
Okay, so it's funny. I have to say, as a comic coming to acting from outside of acting, I think the natural comic bone errs on the side of us, oh, really ridiculous. Why are you going la 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 la? Why are you doing that? Why are you going? Bruh? What are you doing that for before you go on stage? Well, why are you doing all those things? And we're amused by it, and we're amused by the idea of a movement class, and we're amused by walking around a room, making eye contact with people while you say ah or whatever. All of those weird
Yes.
things that actors do. When I went to Lambda, my comedy chops and my comics instinct couldn't cope initially with, like, I told one of the fellow students, on day one, I was like, "The minute we have to walk around a room avoiding people and making noise, I'm gonna stifle, struggle not to laugh." And that's exactly what happened. But the skills and discipline of an actor are something I could have done with more as a comic. And I know there are comedians who come from the discipline of acting and benefit from that when they come into stand up, I think both can complement each other totally. And I think all stand ups are inherently actors. Whether they can do more than a stand up set with that, it is up to them. But I think if you can get on stage on Monday in Hull and tell a bunch of jokes to that audience like they've just come off, off this slip of the tongue, they've just come off your mouth, they've just come off the top of your head, and you can do that again the next night, and that audience is convinced that you're just talking to them, that you're just making this stuff up as you go along. Are you not acting? And you are acting because you also know in your set where the punchline's coming and how you want to receive the punchline, how you're going to behave when you hear the laughter, or when there's a lot of thought that goes into your performance on stage as an act. It's not coming from nowhere. And so there's a lot of paths on which acting and stand-up cross over, I think. But the one place where I think the actor's job has something that stand-up doesn't have enough of, and that's listening. You've got to listen as an actor. Like, that's the best skill, and I think that's the acting I found hardest, is not when I'm performing and talking in a role, but when I'm waiting to talk, because I have to listen. for my reaction to be real, et cetera, et cetera. And I think stand-ups find it hard to listen.
Oh, I agree. What was that?
No, nothing. Amusing myself. But we do, you know, and that's where, like, that's what the element of stand-up that's dangerous, I think, when you're an act, is cutting yourself off from the people that you rely on to be a comedian, and that's an audience, and that's people, and that's mixing with more than comedians. You know, maybe that's great. Maybe you want to totally channel into that. But I've been in a room with three people where two of them were comics and one was a really talented physicist, science teacher, musician, who'd played with Robin Ince, the Infinite Monkey podcast, and all kinds of things. And the two comics never talked to him in the entire time he was sat there, just me and him talking and missing the opportunity to meet someone really interesting who wasn't just going to wank on about his gig last night or his gig in 2 weeks, or, you know what I mean?
That goes on the trip that comedians being narcissists. Why?
No, well, but actors are too. You'll meet the same kind of people in comedy that you meet in acting. But it's just a different game and a different discipline with some similarities.
I feel that from what I've seen of actors, they're a bit more social. Am I right in saying this? If telling me if I'm wrong, but actors seem a bit more... they're more socialized than us comedians. Is that true?
I think
complete bullshit.
I can't blanket say that that's true or not. I think people are people. And the fundamental thing to hang on to when you're in comedy is people are people. And so you will get narcissistic actors, and you will get jealous actors and vain actors and team player actors and everything. But you get all of that in stand-up. You get comics who fuck off and don't watch the other acts. You get comics who love it and stay all night and offer their opinion and advice. You get comics who have no interest in any of the night or the audience. You have, you know, there's comics I can think of where they don't like the audience, you know, and you watch people who have a disregard or an ill regard for the audience, and it might work for them in the style they do. But I think, if that isn't your style, where you're kind of up against the audience, if your style is to talk to a room full of people, you should understand people.
Yeah, definitely. In all art forms, isn't it? Like they say in acting, don't they? Like, a good actor is a good psychologist. Is that sort of the same in comedy?
I think so. Well, I think it just, again, boils down to, like, listen, you know, stand-up is, if you're doing observation or if you're trying to take note of your night, your life, it's all about observation. An actor should be observing people and paying attention to characters and picking up body movement from other people and styles of how people talk or whatever. But a stand-up should be doing the same. And I think when you're crafting out your stage persona, you know, it's very rare, I think, that there are open, it's very rare that someone steps on stage and the persona they are on stage is exactly who they are. We're still masking when we're stand-ups. We try and graduate and gravitate towards being 100% ourselves on stage, but most are still not themselves.
No. It's exaggerated to a side of them that makes people laugh.
Well, it's just, you know, I can think as I wouldn't necessarily take on someone 6 foot bigger, that, you know, like 6 foot tall verbally and have a go at someone on the street. But I've done that on stage with no problem and vicious confidence. But I've been shitting myself about leaving the gig.
Yes, I bet. Now, this is a question that may be on the more. Well, I've got two questions here. So. One of the questions is, that's how I sound, bloody hell. Interesting. Now, one of the things that I've found being as, so there's this guy called, I think, Jim Cock or something. He does, he's wrote this book called Limitless. And it, like, he had.
Jim who?
What's his name? The guy that wrote Limitless. Let me have a look. Limitless book. Jim Quick. So he had terrible memory and he wrote a book.
I'm just going to look it up.
But he.
Go on, Jim Quick's official course, how
But
to read faster and more effective. Yeah.
he's got a book that's really good, that's quite popular, and he found a way of getting really good memory despite him having some sort of brain condition. So I definitely, I'm doing the test for autism and ADHD at some point. I'll find out the results. But with you say you got ADHD and you had Crohn's disease, right? And
Yeah.
later on, I read a bit on your website. Later on, I think you mentioned on the phone that you got a tube that's niche.
I have a tube in my chest that gives me nutrition. But it's been there 20 years. I mean, it changes sides, but I've had a tube in my chest on the left or the right for 20 odd years. Yeah.
How does that actually help you as a comedian actor? Because I've found that with comedians, whether they've been wheelchairs or they got something that's not right, they've already got something that people are a bit, but then they
I
make a
think
joke of it and everyone's all right.
I think it depending on your personality. For me, one way of coping with my health, mental or physical or otherwise, had always been to laugh and to create laughter. Obviously, often after the facts, tragedy, comedy, time, etc. But is to laugh about it, and also in laughing about it and taking control of it, you're saying it before anyone else can. You know, I think that's a thing in terms of the trope of the comedian being bullied. It's like I made the jokes at my expense when I was at school, and I was self-depreciating before anyone could say it. So you're disarming. It's what's his name? Cyrano de Bergerac. I'm going to make every joke about my nose before you make one.
Ah, yes.
You know, so I think being able to laugh about it. I have, you talked about the darkness of comedians or whatever. It's like I had a dark sense of humor, got me through some dark times, and I had to have a sense of humor in those dark times to get out the other side, because there were things that were very difficult to laugh at, but as a coping mechanism, I had to laugh sometimes, because life's fucking crazy, man.
Oh, it is completely
No,
nuts.
I remember, as an example, like a laugh that was amazing was just, not at someone's expense so much, but at the distance I'd traveled. I remember after my suicide attempt, I was getting therapy, regular therapy, and I was driving to Finsbury Park for the therapy sessions, a house in Finsbury Park. And the first loads of times I drove there, I mean, I was thinking about driving into other vehicles. I was struggling to drive. I was struggling to be safe. And I would get there an hour early because I was scared of being late and scared of the journey. And I would pull up at Finsbury Park, and I couldn't get out of the car. And then after a few weeks, I was able to get out of the car and walk a bit. And then eventually I was able to walk around the pond. And this is all before going to my session. And then one day before going to my session at the park, now in a much better place, someone came up to me and they were me 6 months earlier. And I kind of had to laugh to myself because it was like running into the mess I'd been. I mean, I laughed to myself, not laughed at the person, which would have been cunty. But I think laughter has really helped in my life. The same with my suicide story. My suicide story, I was saved by the power of laughter, ultimately. If I had not laughed, I would not come out of the mindset I was in, which was deathly.
Laugh, yeah, that's so, yeah, it is. I don't know what to say to that. That's brilliant. That's
Know what
brilliant.
you can
That's
say.
brilliant.
It's just important to be able to laugh at things, isn't it?
No, definitely.
And also to create that for an audience. It's about escaping. For 2 hours, they want to escape. And there's a fine line as well, is how much do they want to hear about your cancer or Crohn's disease or disability or whatever? And how far can you take them with that? Because some people will be like, I come out to have a good time. I didn't want to hear about that. But you're always going to have them.
And the skill as a comic is to make it funny.
And connect with them. They're just people. And also, like it's very rewarding. Like I will say, doing a show about suicide, it was a really hard show to do for the month I did it. And I did it after that, and I did the story at, particular gigs. But I had people come up to me after that show who'd lost people to suicide and who didn't understand where their friends were at or what their friends were thinking when they took their own life. And in me talking about it in my show, because obviously, like a 50-minute show about a suicide attempt, it's going to be dark at some point, like it. And it was, at the, they say in an Edinburgh show, an audience will plateau at like 30, 35 minutes. So the actual suicide story part of my show was at 30, 35 minutes because I brought them down, but I know I'm going to bring them back up. And it was really empowering. It was hot. It was a hard show to do because you're alone and isolated in Edinburgh, and only you care about your show unless you have a team. But it was incredibly rewarding talking about that kind of stuff. And it meant, again, like I said, with Corrie or any acting work, it's like I had opportunities through that painful experience that I would never have been afforded if I hadn't had that painful experience. I've told my, I've got laughs and told my stand-up story in Blackburn Cathedral at 11 a.m., and halfway around the world and at Soho Fair and all kinds of places. But it was empowering, and it was also great for other people to understand a bit more. And we've had loads of Edinburgh shows, since and before, like that, where people have talked about child abuse and adoption and their parents' divorce and their dad dying and their stroke they had or whatever. You get a lot out of that as the person doing the show. And you get more work.
Yes, that's true. That's the
Yeah. We all want to work.
And that's, yeah. Again, I don't know what to say to that. That's brilliant.
Don't worry, you don't have to say anything. Well, we do, it's a podcast.
That's true. What I want to say there, that's absolutely brilliant. What, so for anyone that's listening
Listening.
right now, how do they find out about you? And yeah, how do they find out about you and get in contact?
My website is www.garethberliner.com. I don't regularly put stuff on that. If you want to follow my regular life, then Instagram's where it's at. I really love Instagram. I use it quite a lot, from reels to whatever. I put on stuff about my life, mundane stuff, funny stuff, motivational stuff, whatever I want. So just follow my Instagram. That's at Gareth Berliner, all one word, GareThBerliner. There you go.
That's brilliant. So, if you want to know, you know where to go. I'll also give you his address as well. Okay. But I'll see you guys soon, and I hope you've enjoyed the episode.
Thanks, Marvin. Pleasure.